We continue our look at cosmogony, which means what? Okay. How it is formed. That's correct. Cosmology is the whole idea of the universe itself and everything that's in it. Cosmogony is specifically the subset of that which involves how something came into existence. Okay, so Genesis 1:1 is a cosmogony. It is a record of how the world as we know it came into being. Okay, and last week we started by looking at the first two verses of Genesis 1, because at this particular point we're at a point where we're looking at directly at the account itself. We've talked a lot of theory up to this point, but now we're dealing with the subject material at hand. And you remember I said that I am convinced that verses 1 and 2 are a prologue to this account, as Moses writes about what was to come in verse 1 and then what was in verse 2, with the first actual creative act starting in verse 3. Let there be light. Okay. Now, let's pause for a moment here and let's talk about a theological concept that we need to insert here called creation ex nihilo, or ex nihilo. How do you pronounce it, Brian? With the H or without? Okay. Yeah, I found both. So for some reason, I like pronouncing the H. So ex nihilo. What is creation ex nihilo? Okay, from nothing. Okay. Basically, the idea that the creation itself occurred without any pre-existing substance. Now, when I say substance, what am I referring to?
Matter.
Particles. Okay, that could be, that's part of it. Energy. Just matter? Just energy? So gravity existed already and God just used it.
Without gravity and without organization.
Okay, right. No organization to it. Well, something that doesn't exist cannot be organized by definition, right? Yeah. Everything, yeah. But I was looking specifically because I want you to notice that when we talk about this substance, we're not just talking about elemental particles, atoms, right? Or subatomic particles, electrons, protons, neutrons, and then quarks and all the other junk that's inside that, right? We're not, or even down to the strings of energy that, you know, we talk about now in modern string theory. But rather everything that would involve the physical universe itself, right? So all of the substances of matter and space and time and forces and law, various physical laws themselves, none of it existed. If you start ex nihilo, you're starting from zip, except for one thing being God. Okay, except for one thing, and that is God. All right, so when we talk about ex nihilo, we're talking from or out of nothing. In Judeo-Christian theology, creation ex nihilo is the idea that all that exists in our physical universe was simply an idea, put that in scare quotes, an idea in the mind of God that is made real as God speaks it into existence. Okay, so it's the concept of that which was only in the mind of God as an idea, for lack of a better term, right? Okay. But then became real, and again, for lack of a better term, from our perspective, I would argue that even the idea of matter in God's mind was real in His perspective. From our perspective, it's a different story, right? We have a different perspective of real than He does, correct? So the idea that God takes that which He had thought of in His eternal decree and in His eternal mind and His eternal will and makes it into something that's real from our perspective. Okay. Now, as both Brian and I have discussed, this concept of the Big Bang Theory assumes the preexistence of material. It also assumes the preexistence of forces, right? Gravity was existing at the point that this thing exploded. Time existed. Now, there's some physicists who want to argue that even time came into existence, but that's illogical within the concept of something exploding inside of time and space. So the Big Bang Theory assumes the preexistence of something, okay? So when we talk about ex nihilo, we're saying God willed all reality to be simply by the exercise of his divine nature, by the exercise of his will as a being who possesses will and intellect and all the other attributes we talked about when we talked about the doctrine of God some time back. All of the very nature of God, his divine nature, he willed it into existence. Now, let me just pause and note something for you. The word said or spoken, God said, God spoke, is anthropomorphic language, right? Because it's hard to write about God doing something unless we have a frame of reference from within our own understanding of something. And so when we say that God spoke, it's anthropomorphic. I'm speaking to you now. I am exhaling air through various parts of my body which produce sounds with my tongue, which are modified, and lips and so forth to produce speech. But that's not what God did, right? Because God possesses none of that. That's anthropomorphic. So when the Bible uses this word said or spoke, it means, I think, God willing something into its existence. Okay? He wills it by virtue of his nature, and his word, again, in scare quotes, becomes known to us. Again, as spirit, God does not speak in the conventional sense. So we have to understand these words in the best sense that we can from a human perspective without at the same time destroying the nature of God. Okay, here's one of the problems. All the various creation myths that existed at the time of Moses in the Mesopotamian Valley all had physical beings who acted as gods. And when they spoke, they were speaking as physical beings. So it makes sense in that world for a God to speak. That does not cross over into Yahweh. He is a spirit being. He is not a physical being. So when we use this word speak or said, we need to be clear about this. This isn't just some words that suddenly shook the universe as though God exhaled air and produced voice. There's something else. It's a will. It's a sense in which something comes to be simply because he wills it to be so. Think about, here's the example I wrote down here. In John chapter 1, it says the Word was with God and the Word was God. The underlying Greek word there is logos, right? This logos is not a literal word, is it not? It's not a literal word, period. Okay? It's not a spoken word, right? What is it? What is this logos? It's a person, but what kind of a person? It is God, the second person of the Trinity. It is the part of the Trinity. Again, I hate the word part, but a person of the Trinity who exists fully as God. He's not a spoken word. But John uses the word word to try to express an idea here that it is the nature of God, the second person of the Trinity, the nature of God that becomes known to us as the Son of God enters into his creation and takes on a noble form. Right? He enters into the womb of Mary to join himself as the divine nature with a human nature in her to become the God-man. So he becomes knowable to us using our senses, right? But before that, he is not knowable from the senses in that same sense. He can reveal himself in other ways as he has in creation and so forth, but But the fact is that what John's trying to get at is this is God's nature being revealed to human beings. Okay, in this case, in incarnation. But in the first case, the first great Logos, Genesis 1-3, again, it's a revelation of something. It's God making something known. What is he making known? He's making known the existence of stuff, okay? So when he speaks, he is speaking a divine nature willing for physical reality to come from it. Where is it coming from? It's coming from his nature as God. See the parallel. And I think that's part of the reason why John uses the phrase in the beginning to discuss this word, because it connects it then to the concept of what God did at the beginning to show a similar type of thing here. God exercises his divine nature and will to reveal himself or to reveal something, to make it real, quote unquote. Okay? Does that make sense? Understand what I'm saying? Or have I lost you? Or don't you care? Okay. I don't care if you don't care. Doesn't matter to me. Okay, so going back to my original supposition that Genesis 1:1-2 is a prologue, Genesis 1:3 then becomes the first act of God to perform this revelation or this revealing or this creation or speaking or whatever word you want to use to describe it. Moses says, said, okay? And God said, let there be light. All right? Now, question. What is this light exactly? Why is Roger, please forgive me for the word I'm about to use, but wrong. Why can it not be that?
What did he say?
Say it again.
It was his essence.
His essence, okay? Why can it not be that?
Did he create something?
Correct. It cannot be any part of the very nature of God himself, because God is... Notice I didn't finish the sentence. There's nothing to add to the sentence. God is.
He is.
There's nothing to add to the sentence. So therefore, God cannot say, let there be something in me that did not exist before. So it cannot be anything from him. Some have suggested, well, this is the glory of God. But the problem is, the glory of God is self-evident within God and self-existent within God. So God can't say, let there be glory. He's already infinitely glorious and always has been. So it cannot be that. Okay? So, I'm glad you went there because I wrote that down already, so thank you for jumping into that for me. Okay? So it's not that. It cannot be the glory or radiance of God himself, for such is uncreated. What else can it not be? Okay, but what is it? Okay, what's the problem with that? Sun, stars, etc.
They didn't exist.
They didn't exist until when? Day four. So it cannot be radiance coming from fusion reactions taking place within hydrogen-filled globs that suddenly burst into fusion reaction and produced light and heat. Can't be that, because they don't exist until day four. Okay? So that's a problem. So what else is it? We're running out of ideas here, aren't we? Okay, some have suggested, well, kind of peeling off what you said, Aaron. There have been some who suggested that this is simply God making things visible. Okay, a visibility. That's what light does, right? You walk around in a dark room, can't see things, you stub your toe. So what do you need? You turn on the light so you can see. So the idea of some is, well, this is simply God creating some sort of visibility in his created world. But what's the problem with that? Okay. All right, so there was apparently a time when light and darkness coexisted. And then needed to be separated. Okay. That's a good one. Engineer figured that one out. But what's the problem with visibility? Here's the problem with it. Who's going to see it? Who needs visibility? There's nothing here. In fact, all of the creatures that would be necessary, that would need any sort of visibility, are all created after the sun, moon, and stars are created. So their visible light comes from created objects. Therefore, there's no need for some sort of visibility. Who's going to need it?
God doesn't
need it. And there's nobody else to need it. Right? Okay? So, what is this light? We pretty much destroyed all the ideas, right? Not really. There is another. Let me... and by the way, if this is a sense of visibility, then where is it now? Where is it? Where does it exist? Is there a light somewhere? Is there a background visibility somewhere? No. Okay, so none of those really help us to really understand it. Okay, so unfortunately, we've struggled with this question for a very long time because nobody can really come to a good answer. But let me give to you a possibility, okay? When I first became a believer in 1980, I went to a small Baptist church in Edina, Minnesota. It's a suburb of Minneapolis. And not too long after I was there, I was on a Sunday night, a physicist from the University of Minnesota who was a believer came and did a talk on Genesis 1:3. And he made a very interesting possibility. Okay? If you drill down far enough into matter, what do you get to? If you drill down far enough into matter, what do you get to? Energy. You get to energy. I mean, we get to the point where we discover that the atom isn't really an object itself at all, because it's got little things inside of it, and then those little things inside of it have little things inside of them, and then those little things have even smaller little things, and little things ultimately made out of pure energy. What kind of energy is it made out of? It's not a trick question. It's made out of light energy. In fact, what is the most famous, equation in physics?
E equals
mc squared. E is what?
Energy.
M is what? Mass. C is what?
Speed of light.
Speed of what?
Light.
Speed of what?
Light.
So let me get this straight. What Einstein figured out was that the mass of an object has energy in it related to what? Light itself. The speed of light in this case produces the amount of kinetic energy in the object. It was the basis, of course, for the entire nuclear program. Once you bust that thing open, guess what happens? All this energy comes out of it. Right? Right? Okay. And so, what if, since we now understand that all matter is actually composed of energy at its most basic level, what if God first spoke into existence the energy that would undergird every elemental thing inside this universe? What if the first thing that he created was the units of energy, the subatomic units of energy that would be necessary to be formed into every imaginable element on the planet? Because even though I think this thing is solid, it is not. It is made up of energy that happens to be held together from my perspective. But if I took a microscope and drilled down into that far enough, I'm going to see little things moving around in there because they have energy. Unless I drop it to absolute zero. But never mind. So what is it? What if it's possible that when God said, let there be light, what he did at that moment was, boom, created the building blocks of the universe itself. All of the elemental energies that would go into creating reality itself. All right. Now you're all sitting there going, All right, so let's deal with some objections to this, right? Because there are some, all right? And they're found in the text. You mentioned a moment ago, God calls the light day, and he calls the darkness night, okay? So he separates them, okay? So maybe when God names it day and night, does that signify then that light must be something related to the days of creation itself as we understand the concepts of day and night? I mean, after all, what is it, our grammatical, historical perspective? We want to take these words to be as literal as possible within their context, right? Okay, so as Brian so aptly put it, day one, right? It's got a numerical prefix on it, so Yom means something related to day. So the obvious conclusion that many will come to is, well, it can't be that because God is separating day from night. So it can't be God separating light energy from non-light energy because he wouldn't call it day and night. But what if the use, well, okay, again, let me state that the use of the word day is subject to interpretation and context. Okay. I realize that we want to make this a 24-hour day, but our problem with a 24-hour day, even at this point, is we don't have a reference point to make a 24-hour day from. And in point of fact, there are a number of cases in even this text, chapter 1 and 2 of Genesis, where the word day is obviously not 24 hours. For example, in Genesis chapter 2, it speaks of the seventh day. How long did that day last? God rested on that day. How long did it last? Did God rest exactly 24 hours and then get back to work again? Or is the 24th, is the seventh day actually encompassing something more? Notice, context matters here. Okay. So, the physicist, when he was describing this, what he's doing is he's saying, here the labels may simply be a way for the writer to communicate, again, anthropomorphically, the distinction between substance and non-substance. Because there is such a distinction. There's matter and then there's non-matter. I mean, we have loads of space. We've been there. We know there's vacuum where there's no matter. Well, there's some, but I mean, there's basically no matter. So there's a difference between that which is substance and that which is non-substance. We might call it emptiness versus non-emptiness. We might call it space versus matter or some other terms like that. God making a separation and distinction. Here's light over here, who has energy to build things. Here is not. Because that is our universe, is it not? I mean, we've already been able to measure the distances of emptiness in atoms themselves. That there's space between those electrons and neutrons and protons, and the result of that is literally emptiness between bits of energy that are floating around and bits that are not energy. And so the labels, what if the labels here are not trying to make a point about a 24-hour reference, but rather trying to say, listen, God created something and then he separated that something from everything else. He called one day and the other night. And what if that is something that the ancient Israelites would really understand? Because what's the difference between day and night? There's light in the daytime, there's darkness at night. They would have understood that. They would have understood the difference between day being a time of light and night being a time of no light. And they didn't have street lights, so they wouldn't have had light pollution like we have. So they would have really understood the concept of darkness, which we don't. Okay. So in other words, Moses is writing, I think, in a way, the argument is that he's writing in such a way saying, listen, God created some building blocks here, and then he made sure that building blocks were separated from everything that was not building blocks in the universe. All right. The next objection that might be made. All right. Now, preacher, you said a minute ago that God created everything ex nihilo, which means he created this light out of nothing, but the elements themselves were formed from the light. Correct? Didn't I just make that argument? Didn't I just make that assumption? Okay. I mean, if God created energy matter as a building block, does that not deny the concept of ex nihilo for everything else that God then speaks into existence? Aha! Got me, right? What if, okay, what if ex nihilo doesn't exactly mean that? But rather, let me ask a couple of questions. Does ex nihilo imply that God cannot use what is pre-existing if he himself created the pre-existing matter? Is it ex nihilo or not? That's a question, right? I mean, after all, you and I weren't created ex nihilo. Man wasn't created ex nihilo, was he? No, man was formed from the dust of the ground. He was already formed from the elements that were made of the ground itself. So not all creation was ex nihilo in the very example itself that we have. So is it possible that ex nihilo doesn't necessarily extend beyond just the initial moment of God forming all that is needed for the universe to exist, and then, through the process of speaking things into existence, uses that pre-existing material to accomplish the goal?
Pre-existing in terms of the physical, put it together.
Yeah.
But it wasn't pre-existing.
Correct. That's my point.
When it started.
Right. It didn't exist before he said, let there be light. Okay. Second, ex nihilo does not necessarily have to extend to the entire substance of a created form. For example, fish did not exist, and then they did. Right? Fish did not exist, and then they did. They were not. Than they were, regardless of whether God rearranged elements with his word to form them. Correct? So we could say that, yes, fish were created ex nihilo. There were no fish. There were hydrogen atoms, and there were iron atoms, and there were all kinds of other things. And God went, let there be fish, and boom, all that he had created in the elemental sense joined together to become a fish. Did the fish exist prior to that? Nope. It existed just as stuff. So ex nihilo doesn't have to mean down to the very substance of the created form. It can mean just the object itself that's being created. But I also have you look at something else. Look at verses 7, 9, and 11 in chapter 1. And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse. Any speaking going on there? Any speaking going on there? Nope. What did God do? He formed it. Correct? He formed it. How about verse 9? Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas. He speaks and things separate, but that's not ex nihilo. They were already there. Right? How about verse 11 and 12? And God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation. Who brought it forth? The earth brought it forth. He commanded it, and it happened. So my point is I'm not denying ex nihilo, okay? Don't accuse me of that. But I'm suggesting that ex nihilo doesn't mean that everything necessarily had to not exist and then suddenly exist. The process of creation can be God forming from what exists to create end results of what he wants. So he creates an earth that's covered with water. He says, okay, move this water over here, and we'll move this water over here, and guess what? Suddenly appears. Dry land. He doesn't say, let there be dry land. He says, let there be a separation of waters to produce dry land. So we need to be cautious about how we use this term ex nihilo. It's easy for us to say, well, everything has to be spoken into existence in this account, but that's not how the account reads. If you're careful with the account, you'll notice that's not necessarily the case. Okay, so let me make some considerations then of this theory. All right. Notice this is a reference to the first day. All right. A moment ago, we talked about the fact that this is the first act of God to create. However, we want to understand the word day, and we can debate that. But clearly, this is the first act of formation. So, if this is, in fact, the formation of elemental reality, it now establishes with it, and this is a point that I'm trying to make in relation to this theory, it now creates or establishes with it all of the various aspects of the physical universe. God doesn't just speak light energy into existence. He speaks all of the elemental substances that are necessary for the universe to exist. Remember I asked you earlier, what is the substance of ex nihilo? It isn't just particles of matter. It's all of the aspects of creation. Time, space, force, law, right? That go together in this process. For example, time now exists. The physical universe now contains the realities of the passage of time. And remember, that's a distinction clearly outside the reality of God himself. How many times have I said in here, when we're doing our study of God, that God has no past or future, time-wise. He is eternally present. Because he doesn't live in the world of time, so all things are eternally before him. You and I have no present. We only have a past and a future. You want me to prove it? No, those words are in the past now. And so are those. And so are those. And these words coming up, oh, now they're in the past. See, we don't have a present. God only has a present. So this is, when God speaks into existence this light, this energy to create the universe, he forms time as the essence of it, because this light energy exists in time, which I think is one of the key reasons why the equation is c squared, the speed of light. Light travels over time. Second, space now exists. Now, I've already made this argument. God separated. He separated matter from non-matter. And notice that specifically in time, right? Which explains the reality of a space-time continuum. Explains the reality of matter and non-matter existing, coexisting in a physical reality. A space-time continuum. Space now exists. There's distance created. Force now exists. The realities of gravity and the other strong and weak forces come into existence with the appearance of matter from which they are derived. Where is gravity derived from? It's derived from matter. It's derived from the existence of stuff, right? The Earth has a gravitational pull because it has matter. Space doesn't have a gravitational pull. Objects have gravitational pulls. A beach ball has a gravitational pull. It's too tiny to measure, but it's there. Because it's made out of matter. So, force now exists. And then, of course, coming together with this creation, our physical laws now exist. All the physical laws that govern space, time, and force are also created in the process of forming these elemental particles. This elemental reality of energy. I keep using the word particles. I don't mean it in the sense of matter. I mean it in the sense of energy. God creates all of these things at this moment to form a physical reality from which all of our existence exudes. And you just take a general physics class, physics 101, your typical university, and you're going to learn these fundamental building blocks of the universe first. Because everything is based on the fundamental building blocks. Right? So God built the fundamental building blocks first. Because everything else is derived from them as he continues in his creative work. Now, let me just pause here for a moment and suggest something that is within this formation of the elemental universe that God also creates something else. What else does he create at this point? Probably. Evening and morning being separation of matter from non-matter, okay? But that's not what I'm referring to. Yes. There's another plane of existence, isn't there? Remember that? We spent a whole lot of time in angelology, didn't we? And what did we discover? There's another plane of existence. There's a plane of existence called the spiritual world. There's a spiritual plane of created beings. And so it's highly likely here that, in a way, Moses hints at the fact that there is such a creation here. And I think the separation of light from dark is also a reference to the separation between the physical and spiritual worlds. Light is seen, darkness is unseen. So it's very possible that in this phrase, as God himself separates that which is seen from that which is not seen, or that which is reality as physical versus reality as spiritual, or as he separates that which he's creating, he's also creating a spiritual plane at the same time.
Genesis 2, verse 1, it says, the heavens and the earth, everything in them.
And everything in them. Correct. Right. It had to be done at this point. Now, I'm also convinced, by the way, that I think God created this spiritual plane and the angelic host in it for one more reason at this early part of the game. And who can tell me why? For them to watch. And how do I know that they're watching? Because that's what the book of Ephesians tells us, that there is a heavenly audience who is observing this. God created a spiritual plane of beings for him to watch. So at the very beginning of the creative process, as God says, let there be everything that'll be needed, he also creates the audience who will now watch him do what? Create the rest. Specifically leading to the point where he then enters into the very planet, or comes to the very planet that he creates, takes some dust from the ground and creates man. Because his whole intention was to glorify himself not through angels, but through man. But through man. Through us. He's going to redeem this people as they fall. He's going to love them and adopt them. No such language like that is ever used about angels. In fact, the writer of Hebrews very specifically says that in chapter 1. The idea being that when God created this realm, he created it for the purpose of observation. So I'm convinced that 3, 4, and 5 of Genesis 1, the best explanation I've ever heard, and of course I could be utterly wrong, you know, not the first time, that God, in fact, what he formed here to begin with is all that which would be necessary to construct the universe itself at its most elemental level, physically and spiritually. Physically and spiritually. And then, as you get into verse 6 and beyond, then you start seeing him take this stuff and begin forming it in all kinds of things, right? Creating an expanse in the midst of the waters. Waters. Okay? So he begins, I think, by starting from a starting point. It's compelling to me. It's interesting. So, anyways, God said, let there be light. And there was. And God created all that is in the universe and everything that is associated with it. Any questions? I suspect that he created it as all at once. He created a fundamental building block, because there's no real difference, you'll notice, in those fundamental building blocks. You get down low enough, you come to the most fundamental level. But that doesn't mean that God created some sort of storehouse of it over here and then he started plucking some out and putting some here and here. He could have created it in such a way that it was spread out throughout space as he needed it to be, to go to wherever he needed it to be. Again, Moses is not able to really define that. And again, as I'm, another thing I'll point out and remind you of, as I said last week a number of times, Moses, I don't think, was attempting to create a science textbook here of how this was created. He's trying to answer a religious question. The religious question is, who created this world? Was it formed by these gods who bleated and then earth was formed and then someone had a baby and another something, blah, blah, blah? Or was it God speaking this into existence? And that's the answer that he's really trying to get to. So we can't be more specific as to what he did in terms of how and where and how much and all that. But since matter is non-replicating, fundamentally, matter is non-replicating, it seems likely that God made it all at once, which then takes into account several quadrillion stars that he, you know, eventually built with it. Yeah. Other questions? Very good. Okay, so in other words, we're seeing God create. He said he was going to, and he did. And we'll move through the rest of the days of creation, which should be easier, by the way, because there's a lot less difficulty in the ones that come. You will notice, by the way, that this narrative gets easier to explain as you go further and further along. Correct. Exactly. Correct. So once we move along the spectrum of it, it becomes easier for us to understand. So by definition, the further back you go, the harder it is to really grasp because we're getting closer to the nature of God. And here we're getting close to the nature of us. So I think the following days are easier.